Thank you so much for inviting me, Professor Federici. I'm so honored because I'm like a rookie, so I feel like one. So in an article entitled Un Sogno, A Dream, which originally appeared in Espresso in December 2003, then republished in A Passo di Gambero, or Turning Back the Clock in 2006, Eco describes a dream of a global blackout that paralyzes the civilized world. This dream posits an end-of-day scenario that both describes a possible future world and revisits the past. The future world he describes, the product of a war made possible by modern technology, is marked by a series of negations that link us to a time before modern technology. No television, no internet, no electricity, and by a sequence of verbs that suggests a resurrection of the past. Riscoprirà will rediscover, rifioriranno will reflourish, and riprenderanno will take up again. Consequently, the survivors in Echo's dream, his family and friends among them, are forced to return to more traditional modes of living. They rediscover what today we would consider antiquated methods of communication. For instance, he says communication will be handled by carrier pigeons. Just imagine how that would work. Education, he says, I would do my bit by teaching grammar and history, not geography. I'll assemble my grandchildren and their friends and tutor them at home, first calligraphy, and then gradually I can give philosophy lessons. And narrating. I will sit down, he says, of an evening and amuse my grandchildren by, now bereft of television, perish the thought, by reading them old books of fairy tales found in the attic, or by telling them about the world before the war. This last point is the crux of Echo's dream, and it is one that raises many questions. In telling his grandchildren about the world before the war, how will he decide what to tell them? Will he recount some events and leave others out? Will he rely on historical texts, even if they even survive the scenario? Or will he rely on his own personal knowledge and memory, which include both his own writing and reading and life experiences? There is an inherent dualism in this dream that immediately takes us back to the authorial debates of the 1960s, when criticism and theory questioned the authority of the author over an interpretation of a text. Eco's vision recaptures the very essence of those authorial debates, since on the one hand, his dream advocates the rediscovery of reading, narrating, or retelling, and yet on the other, it promotes the necessity of an authority figure when reading, narrating, and retelling. So Eco acts as both author and reader in his dream, and consequently, everything he retells, narrates, or teaches must by necessity not only be intertextual, as the knowledge comes from elsewhere, other texts, but since he is also the source of history in this scenario, self-reflexive as well, since he must remember his own experiences within that history, whether read or lived. It is no coincidence that Eco places great emphasis on the importance of the past in his dream about the future. Eco's most recent works, among them La misteriosa fiamma della regina Loana, A Passo di Gambero, La memoria vegetale, and even Il cimitero di Praga, focus on revisiting the past through both cultural, collective memories, often focusing on personal memories as well. In his essay, Alcuni ricordi della mia infanzia fascista, some memories on my fascist childhood, Eco reveals a conscious or unconscious need or longing to step back into the past. He observes that even in these advanced times, history is with us. He says, in the form of a fake review, in a book attributed to Crabbe backwards, I observed that recent times had witnessed technological developments that represented authentic steps back. In the description of his writing phases in a famous essay, Come Scrivo, Eco explains that the final phase of his writing process, determining the style of the narration of his novels, is contingent on the previous step, determining the construction of the worlds of his novels. In this way, Eco's writing phases are like building blocks, each phase reliant on the other in order to ensure a sound structure, the finished text. That Eco has been following this methodology since the beginning of his novel writing suggests not only that the architectural metaphor is implied in all his novels, but that from the start, architecture has always been a part of his experience. Since architecture is the visible structural memory of society through all its experiences and transitions, Eco's novels, which are constructed according to an architectural metaphor, become the narrative memory not only of collective historical experiences, but of his own individual experiences as well. A concept of self-reflexive intertextuality, which I am arguing in my thesis, is dependent on the author's memory, especially since the theory of intertextuality involves looking back. The process of intertextuality is to the equivalent of performing an act of memory, since intertextuality revisits, recollects, and remembers past texts. Self-reflexive intertextuality incorporates the author's personal experiences, especially with reading, and cultural experiences as well. As a result, whatever the author reads and experiences becomes a product of memory and subsequently a product of narrative. From Il Nome della Rosa to Il Cimitero di Praga, Eco evokes memory as the style of the narration of his novels. And he says, quite famously in this essay, Come Scrivo, let us proceed in an ordered way, that is, according to my narrative custom, by taking a step back. The process of looking back in Eco's novels is twofold. On the one hand, his protagonists are constantly revisiting their past experiences, both personal and cultural, in order to recreate them narratively. And on the other, Eco's novels revisit his own experiences, especially with reading and writing. By revisiting many of his own experiences, Eco's memories become part of the narratives of his novels as well. By the time Eco published his first novel, Il Nome della Rosa, in 1980, he had already spent the previous 20-odd years laying down a theoretical foundation for the creation of his text. The novel can be read without the knowledge of these earlier writings, but such a reading lacks a certain substance, especially when much of the meaning of the novel is derived from Eco's past work. Il Nome della Rosa is, more than anything else, an exercise of memory. Memory drives the narrative of the novel, precisely because it is also the driving force behind his previous theoretical writings. In the dream recounted earlier, Eco describes how he must take it upon himself to educate those around him, namely the children. And as most books and other forms of knowledge are lost, everything Eco retells, narrates, and teaches must by necessity develop from a process of memory, a combination of intertextual elements, texts he has read and remembers, and self-reflexive allusions, things he has experienced. This is a perfect scenario for Eco, and one he is totally prepared for. Since his works continuously make reference to past works, both intertextually and intertextually, the past is no stranger to him. In this way, Eco's writing process, which he admits is always looking back, becomes a sort of mnemonic device. Throughout his early theoretical work, Eco explores many types of mnemonic devices, from image to language. Nel problema estetica di San Tommaso Aquino, the aesthetics of St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, Eco examines the role aesthetics comes to play on experience. Though he does not directly treat the relationship between aesthetics and memory, in this first publication, Eco establishes a metaphor for memory, which is architecture, that he not only revisits in future theoretical writings, like in Apocalittici Integrati and in La Struttura Assente, but in his first novel as well. When Eco describes the trend of medieval church architecture to veer towards a more ornamental style, he sets up the debate between Saint Bernard of Clairvaux and Abbé Suger de Saint-Denis on the function of images. Saint Bernard believed that such ornaments were excesses that interfered with concentration of the faithful, and that the appeal of images are judged to be dangerous and perverse. Eco explains that such ornamentation was seen to be, particularly by Saint Bernard, a kind of trap designed to attract generous donations and to manipulate the emotions. Abbé Suger, however, advocates ornamentation and encourages it in his own church to purposefully provoke and incite emotional responses. While Saint Bernard denounces displeasure, Suger embraces it. Each agree that images have the potential to become part of a cognitive process. We gaze upon an image, we have an emotional or even intellectual response to an image, and as such, it becomes part of our experience and consequently part of memory. Eco states in a later work on architecture and memory that if we see something, we remember it better. Saint Bernard rejects these emotional reactions, but Suger can see where an interpretation of an image can go beyond an emotional or an intellectual response. In Eco's next publication, such responses actually enrich the meaning of the work. With Opera Aperta, the open work, the success of what Eco calls an opera in movimento, a work in movement, is not only reliant on the constant interplay between author, artist, text and work, reader, viewer, but also on, and I quote, the possibility of numerous different personal interventions. that allow the opera in movimento to convey meaning. In his analysis of poetic language, Eco begins an examination of language and its association with the process of memory. He poses the questions, how does one bring the memory of past experiences to bear on the present one? And how can the same process be translated into an act of communication between a verbal message and its recipient? Language, according to Eco, is, and I quote, not an organization of natural stimuli like a beam of photons. It is an organization of stimuli realized by man, and as such, an artifact like any other art form. A linguistic message can, thus, according to Eco, have both a referential and emotive function, and are dependent on the collaboration of the sender of the message and its recipient. If this collaboration does not exist, there is a danger of overinterpretation. In terms of a referential message, he says the addressee will automatically personalize his or her understanding of a strictly referential proposition with a variety of conceptual and emotive references culled from his or her previous experience. And the vagueness of an emotive proposition runs the risk of becoming, he says, a series of connotations that go far beyond its most immediate denotations. The author of the message, or the sender, and its recipient must by force work in collusion in order to avoid an interpretation of the message that cannot be supported by the text. To avoid this risk, Eco suggests the emphatic suggestion, and this proposition is in keeping with continuous interplay between author, text, and reader that Eco advocates throughout his entirety of his work. The role of the author or sender is to supply the suggestions that are, he says, intentional, provoked, and explicitly reiterated, but always within the limits fixed by the author, or better, by the aesthetic machine that he has set in motion. The aesthetic machine does not ignore the audience's capacities for response. On the contrary, it brings them into play and turns them into the necessary condition for its subsistence and its success, while directing them and controlling them. These suggestions are at once a part of the author-sender's past experiences and the reader-recipient's. The recipient employs his or her experiences in order to interpret the message, but only those experiences that can relate to and enrich the author's suggestion. Such a discussion clearly prefigures Eco's future works, particularly the role of the reader, the limits of interpretation, and interpretation over interpretation, in which he must reiterate and often almost defend the role of the author and the role of the reader in the interpretation of texts. Eco includes the process of memory in his conception of the opera in movimento because he believes that past experiences can serve as crucial material to the interpretation of an open work. Language works doubly, both referentially and emotionally, to communicate this message. The process of memory is also crucial to Eco's cultural theory in Apocalittici e Integrati. He continues to explore the question asked in Opera Aperta about how to bring past experiences to bear on a present one by integrating his previous concepts of aesthetics to bear on a more contemporary theory of mass media and culture. The work itself provides a model for answering such questions, as he again revisits not only past texts, but his own previous writing as well. He says that it has a medieval model, after all. So he revisits his first publication, The Aesthetics of Thomas Aquinas. Eco's l'uomo di cultura, the man of culture, must be able to move freely between high, middle, and low levels of culture. In order to do so, he must bring with him the experiences gained from level to level. Experiences in one level can be relevant in another, and so on. Such a process almost eliminates the distinctions between levels of culture. In this way, the process of memory is always a part of a cultural movement. Eco is the exemplar of l'uomo di cultura because in his works, Apocalittici e Integrati included, he is always transitioning from one level of culture to another, using personal and cultural memories to enrich the process. This process, he points out, has a medieval model, as I said, and thus he revisits his first publication. In Theories of Memory and Literature posited by Birgit Neumann and Renate Lachmann, fictions of memory, as Neumann calls them, have the ability to teach techniques for remembering. She says, the term fictions of memory deliberately alludes to the double meaning of the works, double meaning of fiction. First, the phrase refers to literary non-referential narratives that depict the workings of memory. Second, in a broader sense, The term fictions of memory refers to the stories that individuals or cultures tell about their past to answer the question, who am I, or more collectively, who are we? I don't think we can ever answer those questions, but we try. These are questions people spend their lives trying to answer. I'm trying to answer them too. But often, the answer comes in no real tangible form. Authors like Eco attempt to answer these questions through their writing, structuring their memories in a narrative form. Lachman similarly describes both literature and writing as a process of memory as well. When literature is considered in the light of memory, it appears as the mnemonic par excellence. Literature is culture's memory, not as a simple recording device, but as a body of commemorative actions that include knowledge stored by a culture. And virtually all texts a culture has produced and by which culture is constituted, writing is both an act of memory and a new interpretation by which every new text is etched into memory space. Lachman considers writing an intertextual process where authors of texts draw on other texts, both ancient and recent, belonging to their own or another culture, and refer to them in various ways. They allude to them, they quote them and paraphrase them, they incorporate them. But she makes no comment on how authors draw from their own texts and their own individual experiences within their own culture as well. Such an inclusion broadens the definition of intertextuality and enables connections to be made with the author's previous work, both nonfiction and fiction. These memories clearly become material for fictions of memory. And to continue the architectural metaphor, they are placed in what Lina Bolzoni calls memory space, or in what memory Carruthers describes as a memory storage, where, when called upon, memory becomes active. Memories become active. The writing process can thus be considered a way in which to make memories tangible. The writing process organizes memories within the space of the text. Most modern theorists and historians of the art of memory, Eco included, consider the relationship between architecture and memory an ancient one. Works on memory like those from Paolo Rossi and Francis Yates trace this relationship back to Cicero's, then Quintilian's, account of the poet Simonides, who is the sole survivor of a building collapse, lucky him. The tale describes how Simonides recalls the details of the event and the location of its victims by remembering them in the architectural space they had been occupying. In his essay on architecture and memory, Eco instead revisits the story found in Plato's Phaedrus of the Egyptian god Teuth, who offers the invention of writing to the pharaoh. The pharaoh rejects the gift, believing that memory alone is man's most precious commodity, and that writing could render it obsolete. Whereas the tale of Simonides makes explicit only the relationship between architecture and memory, Eco's Platonic example links the process of writing with architecture and memory. The pharaoh was mistaken, he says. He was mistaken because, as we know, the practice of writing has not killed memory, but has actually made it more efficient. And he was mistaken because, since the most ancient times, space and memory have been very closely linked. The metaphor of space is so basic in describing memory processes that even contemporary psychology, describing the behavior of our brain in building and retrieving memories, uses spatial metaphors. For Eco, remembering is like constructing. And architecture, he says, from its beginnings, has been one of the ways to fix memories. To recall events, we build monuments. Exploits are recorded on stones, plaques, steles, obelisks, columns. And in modern times, as in ancient times, architecture superintends the construction of containers for the documents that represent the memory of a civilization, the library, the archive, the museum. In this manner, through the writing process, Eco constructs texts that simultaneously recall both historical and personal memories. The text, like an architectural structure, is a space where these memories are organized, or to use Carruthers' term, become active. Not coincidentally, the containers that Eco explains retain the memory of civilization, the library, the archive, the museum, all figure greatly as representations of memory in his novels. The form of the narration that Eco adopts for his novels is a continuous looking back, a process of memory. According to Franco Forchetti in Il Segno alla Rosa, the memory of the characters in Eco's novels represent the precondition of the narrations. Through the technique of flashback, Azzo, Casaubon, and Roberto tell their story. Memory is therefore undoubtedly an integral part of Eco's novels. In Il Nome della Rosa, not only does Azzo's narrative depend on his own memory in order for him to write his manuscript, but memory also plays an essential role in the lives of the monks whose stories are being retold by him. Azzo's narrative in Il Nome della Rosa starts, quite aptly, in the beginning, with a biblical passage that reminds us that memories are often unclear. But notwithstanding the sometimes illegible fragments of the truth of his memories, Azzo endeavors at the end of his life to clear the fog of his memories by writing about his youth. He begins his narrative by looking back, preparing, he says, to leave on this parchment my testimony as to the wondrous and terrible events that I happened to observe in my youth, repeating verbatim all I saw and heard. At the same time, however, that he promises to retell these events accurately, he admits he is confused by them. Through time, Azzo's memories have converged with other memories of other events, transforming the initial memory that he had so that it can bear meaning on a present experience, which for Azzo is his first and last venture with writing. As many of these events have become confused in his memory, Azzo must utilize mnemonic techniques, mainly architecture, in order to organize them. The ending of Azzo's narrative, and thus the ending of Eco's novel, reaffirms the consideration of an opera in movimento. In a significant passage at the end of the novel, Azzo describes his return to the abbey several years after its destruction. I won't read the whole passage because it's so long, but he describes him returning to the library and trying to pick up fragments of texts that, you know, were burned and the remnants, and then he tries to put them together like a puzzle. Azzo reconstructs the events through a process of memory. He arranges the texts he finds from within the rubble in his manuscript through a process of memory, both personal and cultural. He writes the manuscript in the hope that someone might find it and read it, and through reading it might revisit his life and the events and texts described within it. The reader of the manuscript subsequently incorporates it into his or her memory, and so on, with each reading being a new interpretation. The ending of the novel thus brings the reader back to the beginning. Il Nome della Rosa begins with the final point of the tale in Ultima Res, when Azzo is already an old monk in the Abbey of Melk, completes a voyage à rebours in memory, thus giving a start to its re-evocation from Franco Forchetti. The final point of the novel brings the reader back to the initial point, to the unknown reader-writer and discoverer of Azzo's manuscript. The passage also both affirms Eco's cyclical mode of writing by bringing the reader back to the beginning of the novel and makes a comment on the process of writing as irrevocably intertextual and inevitably self-reflexive. Il Pendolo di Foucault, like Il Nome della Rosa, begins again as an act of memory that occurs in what Eco has termed a container of memory, the Conservatoire des Arts et Métiers in Paris. At the outset, Eco makes a distinction between two types of memory, the one that allows a work to move and the one that is absolute. Forchetti aptly calls this the war between worlds of memory. Casaubon's narrative begins with the description of the pendulum. The back and forth movement of the pendulum, a representation of the world, also becomes a metaphor for memory and narration. From the novel, he says, each swing of the pendulum would make like a light furrow, and the furrows, changing direction imperceptibly, would widen to form a breach, a groove with radical symmetry, like the outline of a mandala or a pentacalum, a star, a mystic rose. No, more a tale recorded on an expanse of desert, in tracks left by countless caravans or of nomads, a story of slow millennial migrations, the tip retraced, narrating anew in compressed time what they had done between one ice age and another, and perhaps were doing still, those couriers of the masters. Memory is thus the driving force also of Casaubon's own narrative, oscillating back and forth as it does between memory and his present reality. Notwithstanding the fact that memory moves Casaubon's narrative, he is trapped in a place of memory, the Museum of Technology, where things that should and once moved can no longer. He says, symbols now, not instruments. The sequence of machines and museum oddities Casaubon observes from his hiding place in the periscope is spouted off in list form and at a frantic rate, as if they have the ability to drive him a little mad. He says the only thing that you can rely on at a time like this is the laundry list. Stick to facts, causes, effects. I'm here for this reason and also for this reason and this. Memories, distinct, precise, orderly, of the past three frantic days, of the past 2 years, and the 40-year-old memories I found when I broke into Jacopo Balbo's electronic brain. I am remembering now as I remembered then, in order to make sense of the chaos of that misguided creation of ours. Now, as then, while I waited in the periscope, I shrink into one remote corner of the mind to draw from it a story. This war of the memories, to use Forchetti's phrase, in Eco's novel becomes more complex when we consider, as Joanne Cannon does in her essay on the imaginary universe of Umberto Eco, a reading of Foucault's Pendulum, the memory of the author. Cannon ponders whether it is the critic's job to reconstruct the references on which this compendium of arcane knowledge is based. Should one read the novel as an autobiographical projection of the author's theories? Cannon takes a hybrid approach, believing that both elements, autobiographical and theoretical, are helpful in interpreting Eco's second novel. Model readers of Eco's works would undoubtedly respond affirmatively to Cannon's question, and several critics of the novel, Capozzi and Cotroneo included, to name a few, support this intertextual level of reading, as well as the intertextual and the self-reflexive. In his essay Il pendolo di Foucault, Kitsch o Neopostmodernismo, Capozzi notes the novel's hybrid intertextual elements. He says, the pendulum intends to be a text which comes to, in which come together, collide, and merge myths and history, high culture and pop culture, science and mysticism, philosophical notions, and banal information. Therefore, Eco's novel presents itself like a data bank of memory, or better, as an orgy of information that goes from those that are socio-historical and literary to those perhaps more banal of our popular culture, all useful information with which to display an encyclopedic baggage. He also notes the intertextual aspects. However, Il Pendolo, other than being intertextual, is also very narcissistically intratextual for its numerous references to Eco's essays and literary articles, collected in volumes that go from Diario Minimo and Apocalittici Integrati, Sugli Specchi ed Altri Saggi, to theoretical works like Opera Aperta, Poetiche di Joyce, Lector in Fabula, Semiotica e Filosofia del Linguaggio, Arte e Bellezza nell'Estetica Medievale. And Cotroneo maintains that Il Pendolo di Foucault is one of Eco's most autobiographical novels. And I quote, in Pendulum, all the characters are autobiographical. Casaubon is, Balbo is, and Balbo still when he writes at the computer, and Dallier when he recounts his esoteric studies. Eco, therefore, did not preoccupy himself with the autobiographical traces left in the novel. On the contrary, he will admit them explicitly. And while in Nome della Rosa, autobiography was of the second level, in the Pendulum, the author risks more. He does not hide and concedes to the reader the possibility of finding him between the pages. The author enters the scene. Eco is present within the pages of his novel as a result of a process of looking back, a process mirrored by his characters, whereby he offers a narrative version of specific personal memories. There is an element to the novel that always takes the reader back to childhood memories. Abulafia, in a way, becomes a cautionary tale, like many children's stories, about right or wrong, or in this case, about the dangers of overinterpretation. The novel itself ends with Casaubon remembering his childhood. He says, in the midst of rose, but you have to walk barefoot with your heels calloused from childhood, there are peach trees. And his own recollection of his child with Leah, and then nothing, there's an oblivion. The author, however, does not fade into oblivion, as Casaubon does at the end of his novel. Rather, it is the author's personal memories that survive the overinterpretation of the contents of Abulafia. That Eco's experiences with reading and writing within culture become materials used to construct the world of his novels is proof positive that his narratives are at one and the same time self-reflexive and intertextual. That Eco must refer to past works in order to defend or clarify present ones verifies that for Eco, memory is necessary, as was previously argued, in order for work to move. Eco's works continuously move from past to present. Every theoretical treatise and novel becomes an accumulation of experiences. He says, and this is already quoted before, when I write a theoretical text, I try to reach from a disconnected lump of experiences a coherent conclusion. When I write a novel, on the contrary, even though starting probably from the same lump of experiences, I realize that I am not trying to impress a conclusion, I stage a contradiction. Taken as a whole, then, Eco's works become an archive of memory or experiences both personal and cultural. Pierre Nora, in his essay Between Memory and History, Les Lieux de Mémoire, maintains that modern memory is above all archival. He goes on to say that what we call memory is in fact the gigantic and breathtaking storehouse of a material stock of what it would be possible for us What we call memory is in fact a gigantic and breathtaking storehouse of a material stock that it would be impossible for us to remember, an unlimited repertoire of what might need to be recalled. Leibniz's paper memory has become an autonomous institution of museums, libraries, depositories, centers of documentation, and data banks. Within his novels, Echo explores several of these institutions, as I said, of memory, the library in The Name of the Rose, the museum and the computer in Foucault's Pendulum, and even the attic in The Mysterious Flame. He also includes the writing process as material for memory archives. Adso's manuscript, Roberto's diary, Badolino's parchments, all which revisit and reconstruct individual and collective past experiences. Echo's final phase of his writing process is such that both storehouses of memory and written manifestations of memory are assembled in his novels in order to create what Nora calls, following Leibniz's example of paper memory, an archival memory. At a conference in Milano in November 1991, Echo was already considering various types of memory, organic, mineral, and vegetal. He says, "Organic memory that registered and administered by our brain, but with the invention of writing, we assist in the birth of mineral memory. I say mineral because the first signs are engraved on clay tablets, carved by rock, because architecture is also part of a mineral memory, and if the first ideograms had a mineral support, the most up-to-date have a mineral support as well. That of computers whose primary material is silicon. But with the invention of writing was born little by little the third type of memory that I have decided to call vegetal. Vegetal was the papyrus, and with the advent of paper since the 12th century, books are produced with linen, cloth, hemp, and canvas. And finally, the etymology both of biblos and liber refers to the bark of the tree. In this manner, books become the epitome of paper or vegetal memory. Echo places special emphasis on books, perhaps because he is a writer himself, and their ability to note to not only provide documentation of cultural history, but their potential to provide personal histories as well. He says the book, in whatever form, has allowed writing to personalize itself. It represented a portion of memory, also collective, but selected according to personal perspective. With books, there is a continuous interplay between cultural and personal memory, which is drawn together by the act of reading. As was previously mentioned, an author must by necessity be a reader in order to write. What he or she writes is not only an accumulation of those personal reading experiences, but of cultural experiences as well. We are drawn and attracted to certain books. Oh, I'm sorry. I lost my place. A reader's and writer's relationship with books is always personal. We are drawn and attracted to certain books. We pick them up, we leaf through their pages, and when we are ready, we read through its contents, form opinions, and make interpretations. He says, in the face of books, we seek, however, a persona, an individual way of seeing things. We do not seek only to decipher, but we also try to interpret a thought, an intention. An author like Echo is able to provide a narrativized version of these opinions and interpretations in a way that incorporates seamlessly this cultural and personal relationship with books. Echo's fifth novel, The Mysterious Flame, finds the main protagonist, Yambo, deprived of his personal memory. His reading memory is still intact. Echo has Yambo retrace his personal memory appropriately through the process of reading. In other words, through his paper or vegetal memory. The Mysterious Flame is above all, again like all his others, a novel about memory and its various types. Through his character of Dr. Grattarolo, Echo re-examines his previous categories of memory. Grattarolo says, "We have different types of memory. One is called implicit, and it allows us to do with ease various things we've learned, like brushing our teeth, turning on the radio, or tying a tie. When our implicit memory is assisting us, we're not even conscious of remembering. We act automatically. And then there's something called explicit memory, by which we remember things and know we're remembering them, but this explicit memory is twofold. One part tends nowadays to be called semantic memory, or public memory, the one that tells us a swallow is a kind of bird, and that birds fly and have feathers. This is the first type to form even in children. It takes the child longer, however, to develop the second type of explicit memory, which we call episodic or autobiographical. It's episodic memory that establishes a link between who we are today and who we have been. And without it, when we say I, we're referring only to what we're feeling now, not to what we felt before, which gets lost, as you say, in the fog. Echo's description of explicit memory, or autobiographical memory, reestablishes the importance of revisiting past experiences in order for present experiences to have meaning. In his essay, Double Coding Memorabilia in The Mysterious Flame of the Queen Loana, Capozzi supports this claim, asserting that what is most impressive in Echo's novels is the way the author integrates important texts, events, and ideas from the past within stories that are concerned with critical issues of our time. In Echo's paradigmatic vision of history and culture, both visual and textual, readers have in fact become accustomed to looking for revealing analogies and associations that bounce back and forth between the Middle Ages, the Age of the Baroque, and our own times. In order for Yambo to recover his personal memory in the present, he must revisit his past. He does so by reacquainting himself with his personal archive. Yambo's personal archive, a collection of comics, books, and illustrations from his youth, coincides with what Echo categorized as a vegetal or paper memory. It is explicitly this type of memory that allows Yambo to reconstruct the memories of his personal experiences. In fact, Yambo equates paper memory with identity. Before the second part of the novel dedicated to paper memory, Yambo considers Zadzetsky's method for remembering. He says, paper, paper, like all the books in this apartment or those in my studio, my memory is made of paper. And thus on paper, he gradually rediscovered himself. You're not him, but what struck me is that he reconstructed for himself a memory made of paper. The fact that the archive that Yambo employs to reconstruct his personal memories is admittedly the same as Echo's own personal archive, again supports the argument that an author's use of intertextuality is self-reflexive. In an interview he had with Harcourt Books, Echo says, "Since I tell about the 30s and the 40s of the last century, I am remembering the period of my childhood and adolescence. It is obvious that the majority of the memories of those times are my personal memories, and that all the images of magazines, discs, and comic books are the images of my personal memorabilia." At the same time that Echo provides a narrative of his own personal experiences in the novel, he also provides a narrative of cultural experiences, given that one of his intentions was to write a biography of a generation. The Mysterious Flame works as the perfect self-reflexive intertextual novel, since it is the seamless merging of intertexts and intratexts, personal and cultural memory and experiences. In a way, this paper required a revisiting of paper memory, much like Yambo's. While revisiting the archive of Echo's works, the figure of the author came to light. Thank you.